Are you really buying a car online on AutoTrader right now?
Really?
At a playground?
Yeah, really. Look at these listings from dealers.
Wow, your search can really get that specific.
Really?
And you just put in your info and boom, car's in your budget.
Mom needs a second, honey.
You can really have it delivered?
Really? Or I can pick it up at the dealership.
Mom! One sec, sweetie.
Mommy's buying a car.
Mommy, look!
I think your kid is walking up the slide.
Kyle, again? Really?
Auto Trader. Buy your car online. Really?
Hello, and welcome to episode 252 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
In a couple of weeks, the United States will celebrate its 250th anniversary. That's a remarkable milestone. Democratic republics are not known for their longevity, and yet the American experiment has endured for a quarter of a millennium. At the same time, Americans seem to disagree more than ever about what that history means. There was a recent article in The Atlantic that argued that one of the country's growing challenges is that we no longer share a common story about our past. Some people emphasize America's failures, such as slavery, segregation, and the mistreatment of Native Americans, while others focus on its achievements, constitutional government, individual liberty, and economic opportunity. Both, of course, are part of the story. But what strikes me is that many of us seem uncomfortable embracing the full complexity of our history. We often approach the past the same way we approach politics, looking for facts that reinforce what we already believe. History becomes less about understanding and more about validation. But nations, like people, can be complicated, and most of us understand that our own lives contain moments of both pride and regret. So, Rick, as we approach our nation's 250th birthday, I wanted to ask and maybe start our conversation here. Why do you think it's so difficult for people to embrace the full story of our country?
In some ways, it's a mark of our very success as a pluralistic democracy, welcoming people from all these other countries with different traditions, different histories, but with their own stories and bringing that here. And we have celebrated for so long now and welcomed a diversity of cultures. And most recently, that's come to mean we teach kids in our schools all these different stories. We don't any longer have a common core, for example, that we teach at universities, in high schools, even in grade schools. Kids don't read in schools throughout the country the same set of books. The question is, like, why can't we agree on a single story? There's nowhere in our country where we say, like, let's all know one story. Let's share a story. And so it's no surprise that we can't agree on our nation's story. We are a place that is trying to figure out how do we have one story among many, and we just can't quite figure out how to do it.
And does that make our country less strong, do you think, that we don't have sort of this narrative that we all sort of agree upon, and that we, you know, that we look on this, you know, big anniversary, 250 years of our country, and many of us look at that really important milestone really differently?
Yeah, and I think it does make us less strong. Our very diversity gives us a huge breadth of experience and perspectives that we can bring to bear on all kinds of issues that confront the world. As a nation, when we want to have, like, unified action on something, it's really hard for us to come together. We're seeing the dysfunction, especially in national government, because we can't come together unified on just about any topic. And, of course, that makes us less strong. One of the hallmarks of strength is unity. I don't know if it's, I mean, I think it's a bad thing that we can't have agreement on a nation story. I think that's really important. And I think it's important for, especially for children, to be able to have some sense of how we're bound together and where we're going. This is what a story does. It tells us our past and it points towards the future. I think it would be better off if we could come to agreement on something. I just don't see how we do it without a common cultural inheritance, because nation stories always come out of a shared culture.
You think it's important we come up with the shared narrative, you said.
Yeah.
How important in that is that shared narrative be entirely unimpeachably true?
It can't be. Well, you referred to why is it so difficult for people to embrace the full story mm-hmm. of their country? The full story would include everything.
Sure.
Right?
And everything's a lot.
Yeah. So this American philosopher, Josiah Royce, who lived about 100 years ago, he had this remarkable idea. He said, imagine a map that contains everything. It would be as large as the world. It wouldn't be a map.
Yeah.
And then it would be useless, right? Because then if you're trying to figure out where you're going to go, you consult the map, you have to figure out where do you go on the map, right?
Yeah. It reminds me of a comedian, Stephen Wright joke, who would say, I have a map of the world. Do you want to see it? Sure. And he's like, look around. 1 mile equals 1 mile.
Right. That is the idea exactly. So here's the whole story. We start from the beginning, and it would include every person and all you know, you wouldn't have time to tell it, right? A story is always an abbreviation. It's always highlighting. It's picking out some features. And so it is always, in some respects, a fiction. It has to be true in certain respects. That is, it can't contain obvious falsehoods. So it's an abbreviation. But it's what it does is it selects out what we agree to be really important. And that's the troubling thing, is like we can't agree right now on what's really important about our shared history. And most importantly, we can't agree on where we're going, what we want the story to direct us towards. That's a sign of our failure to really live in meaningful conversation with one another.
And we say this so easily overlaps with politics. And as you're saying that, it makes me think about our somewhat fractured media landscape in this country, especially at the national level. And I think we can agree that Fox News has a different approach to the news than MS Now or the former MSNBC does, right? But I think truly, if you look at those two news sources with a fair amount of objectivity, it's not like one is consistently lying and the other one is consistently telling the truth. It's more often what topics, what news reports they highlight and spend time and focus on that really sort of sets the agenda for those news channels.
Yeah.
And I think, as I hear you say, that yes, our 250 years is a long time, and we've had I don't know how many hundreds of millions of people who have lived in this country. You can't tell every one of those stories, so you have to make choices, and you have to decide what sort of best tells that story. And of course, what worries a lot of people is who is making those choices and who is sort of deputized to tell that story. And in a country right now that seems to be very not friendly to institutions and not trusting of institutions, I can see a lot of people saying, well, they're just gonna tell the story in a way that only makes their side look good. And I'll let you respond here in a second, but it makes me think about, you know, we're recording this late June and July 4th is just around the corner, but we've already had some spectacles, I guess, in Washington that our president has done in preparation, you know, one sort of celebrating his birthday, which was in the middle of June, and sort of these other things that are leading up to it. And like, it's like, I think too bad that we couldn't have had like what was pitched to be like a national fair of just people coming together and celebrating. But of course, we couldn't have that. It had to be something that was political. And then I also wonder, too, if Kamala Harris would have won, would we have spent all of our time sort of lamenting all the awful things that we've done in this country? And that's not a short list, but not like celebrating what it means to be an American. So that's sort of my long, maybe somewhat disjointed preamble. But which of that makes sense to you?
Well, it makes quite a bit of sense that we've got two extreme voices in what's been known as the cultural war, right? And then the extreme voice in the cultural left is so focused on raising up the marginalized that they resent or resist any attempt of celebrating something, some people, some traditions or institutions that haven't been marginalized, but have been mostly responsible for the major achievements in our country. And so they don't want to focus on the major achievements. They want to focus on raising up the marginalized. And I don't disagree that that's a worthy project to do. The problem is when that becomes the only focus, you leave out major parts of what can combine us and what actually tells some kind of coherent story of how we got where we are today. The reaction to that on the right is saying, well, if all you're trying to do is raise up the marginalized and then we're being left out of the story, we're going to insist that we become front and center. And we'll make it all about power. And so then you get the UFC fight on the White House lawn, right? Which is a reaction to the radical left. You have the radical right doing something that's really going to provoke them.
That sounds like a great way to bring America together, Rick.
Well, that's a problem right now. Like, where's the centrist voice right now in our culture? Because the politics is so dominated by those two extremes, we don't have the centrist voice saying, yeah, but we can do all of that, but what about the just telling the story of what brings us together? Augustine said this: a community is defined by what the people love in common. When we do surveys of the American public and we ask them, like, what do they love? There's all kinds of things that they love. They love their neighborhoods. They love summers, for example. Right now, we're in summer.
Well, maybe if you talk to people in Phoenix, it might have a different answer. But yeah, I know your point's made. Yeah.
And mostly, they love their country.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they love freedom. They love the fact that we have representational equality, that people have the right to vote. I mean, these very basic things that have always been part of the core teaching of American history. Most people love these things about our country, and they don't take them for granted. And there's a lot to celebrate. And I think we need leadership that will go ahead and celebrate that and not be so worried about scoring points against the other extremes.
And I was pretty young when our country celebrated its bicentennial. My one memory of that is I had a coloring book that I really don't remember, but I can imagine it had like the Statue of Liberty and Mount Rushmore and other sort of American icons that you would color as a kid. And I don't have a whole lot of memory around that. I know you're a few years older than I am, and I think we talked about this not on the air a couple of weeks ago, but you have a little stronger memory of the bicentennial. Do you feel like that 50 years ago, and you know, remember, 50 years ago, we were coming out of Vietnam, Watergate was, you know, really in the recent past. Gerald Ford was president, but he had just pardoned Richard Nixon. I mean, there was a lot of going on in the world of politics back then. But from what I hear from people who were around back then, you saw many more flags. I know I was talking to a friend of mine who said his parents bought him and he was a kid at the time, bought him like a red, white, and blue bedding set that was like on his bed all year. I mean, it was just like showing your patriotism was very different 50 years ago when we were marking 200 years.
Yeah, in the American flag, and in typical American fashion, it became a major marketing tool. So like all these products started coming up branded with the American flag. You didn't really see it before that. And then all of a sudden, like, I remember us going to JCPenney's, which was 10 miles away. It was in the nearest town that had department stores and things in it, to do some school shopping for the upcoming year. And they had a pair of tennis shoes that were red, white, and blue. Their American flag. And I wanted those so bad. And the only pair that, the closest pair that was really like a half size too small. And of course, I was 14 years old at the time. I was growing out of shoes, you know, like growing a half a size every 3 or 4 months. And so I, you know, there was no, and I was trying to convince my mom that, no, they really fit perfectly, even though I could barely cram my feet into them. But there was, you just saw the American flag everywhere. We also had the Freedom Train that came through from town to town, traveled all over the country. It was a traveling story of America. It was a museum exhibit, basically, and school kids would line up. And I remember we would walk through, you'd go from one car to another, and you're just going through a museum exhibit telling the American story. Those were all really powerful things. And even though the marketing probably got overbearing, kind of in typical American fashion, it was still celebratory. And there were real reasons at the time to be discouraged about America.
But it's, I mean, I would think it was true then, and I think it can certainly be true now, that it's possible to love your country while also acknowledging its failures. I don't think you have to pick one or the other.
There's all kinds of people in our lives that we love while acknowledging their failures. Like loving somebody in your family doesn't mean that you pretend that they're perfect. And the same thing goes for a country. I mean, I'm a Christian. I believe that all our institutions are fallen. They're sinful, and that's in our own lives. We harm one another. We break our promises. We do all kinds of things that then we have to say that we're sorry for. And this is kind of the path of life: is we hurt people, and then we ask for forgiveness, and we hope to come back together again. And this is the story of our country, just as it's the story of any country that's honest about its history. It's a story of failures and achievements both.
And that reminds me very much of an experience I had earlier this year. Back in April, Travis and I visited South Carolina, the Charleston area, and it was the first time for both of us there, and we did a lot of different things, but one day we took our rental car out to the Magnolia Plantation, and I was like not sure what to expect because I know a little bit about what plantations were for and how they got built and how they why they existed. And I was kind of curious to see how this would be presented. And yes, there was the house tour. There was sort of a tour where you could kind of see the grounds on this. They called it a train, but it was really more like a stinky kind of vehicle that sort of ran down the trails. But they also had, which I thought was maybe the strongest part of the visit there, a tour called From Slavery to Freedom. And the guide, who interestingly was from Ireland, which I don't know if that made it good or bad, but you could just tell by his accent, but was talking in really great detail, and I'll assume it was pretty accurate detail, about how clearly this place was built and run on slave labor, and there at no time did they say, oh no, but we here treated our slaves better than the folks down the street. No, that's not what they said at all. And they would talk about in this, and it started near these buildings where you could go inside, and where they were, you know, when I call them buildings, they were really not much more than a shack, of where these families, sometimes pretty large families or sometimes two families, would share in these very, very close quarters and how they would work these very long days and how, of course, they're doing all this sometimes a month after coming over from another continent on a boat and often being separated from their families. I mean, they talked about all this pretty honestly. And then post-emancipation, they talked about how some chose to stay there, some chose not to stay there, and how their conditions, living conditions, although were not fantastic if they stayed, certainly got better. And but it was, I think, did a pretty good job, and I'm not an expert on U.S. Southern history, but I think it seemed to me to tackle what was a difficult story responsibly and was really to try to impart on you the horrors of what slavery was like and what it was like to be part of that. And I when you were talking about telling these difficult stories, I think we can't ignore things like that. But when I walked away from that, I certainly thought to myself, well, of course, I can't imagine what it would be like to have lived through that as an enslaved person. But also, I didn't walk away from it thinking our country is just some evil, awful place. I mean, I think you can hold reverence for your country while acknowledging that really deep, dark past and hold those thoughts at the same time.
Well, if you can't, right? So if you can't do that, if you can't acknowledge that, you can't live in any actual place in the world. Because any actual place in the world has a history, and there are parts of it that are pretty dark. America did not invent slavery. Mm-hmm. Slavery was institutionalized as far back as we can go in history. We find people are enslaving one another. So the achievement of ending slavery and ending legalized slavery, at least, was a pretty remarkable achievement. Now, I don't think we've ever quite come to terms with the cost that it took to end slavery. And I think you're right that we have a hard time even acknowledging that that darkness in our past. It's not just hard to talk about. It's hard to explain because there's so much self-deception that takes place in the rationalization of a practice like this, that really it's almost inconceivable. How can you understand a culture that institutionalizes practices like this? Well, then you ask, okay, how do we understand a world right now where we're buying smartphones that are electric cars that are powered through slavery in the mining of the minerals that are needed to power the batteries? There's still a great deal of self-deception in our telling the story of who we are and what and even of our accomplishments. I think we ought to be completely honest about those things, that we aren't fully telling the story of our past. We're also not telling the story of our present. And we should be.
One of the questions I get asked most often when people know me and hear our show and listen occasionally, the most common question I get is, how do you and Rick decide to pick up on topics, or what topics do you decide to go with? And this one was not tough, right? I mean, this one was sort of, there's a big national event coming up with the I'm going to try to say it again. Here we go. It is the semi-quincentennial.
You got it.
I got it. I have to pause, though. But yes, as we're marking the nation's semi-quincentennial, that this seemed like an obvious time for us to have a conversation around this. It also, though, seems like this is a time when a lot of Americans could be having conversations around family dinner tables, around with friends they know. And I think that probably will happen more over the next several weeks than would normally happen. And What do you, I mean, and obviously there will also be plenty of time to, for families to get together, for celebrations, all those things too. And that's all good. So, I mean, is as people are listening to this show and thinking about how they're going to spend their next few weeks, and hopefully they have a couple days away from work or time with friends and family to not only celebrate, but reflect on our country. Is there kind of a message you'd want them to take from this show that that would be kind of a way for them to have those conversations and either with their friends and family or sometimes just with ourselves?
Yeah, I think there's opportunity to reflect on what we love about our country, and I think we've talked before in this podcast about how important the practice of gratitude is, and we named the sorts of things we're grateful for. When it comes to our country and especially our government, we mostly complain. And if you think of, like, what are the conversations you've had about our government over the last 3 or 4 weeks, it's mostly talking to people who are complaining about things.
Mm-hmm. Prices are too high. We're at a war that seems to be never ending. Things like that, which are important things.
Yeah. The dysfunction in Congress.
Yeah.
Right. All these things. But there's also a lot of really good things to be grateful for. And we should be grateful for them. And a birthday is a time for celebrating and the thinking of acts like on achievement, what we're grateful for. And that's not a bad thing. It gives you a starting point from which to address the problems. And the thing is, people need energy to address their problems. What happens if you only focus on the things that are bad? People get lethargic. They start to give up. They stop paying attention to what's going on in our government. They stop asking, how can I participate locally, for example? And they just say, oh, I'm going to just immerse myself in distractions. And so you have to instill a kind of pride and gratitude for the place where we live in order for us to have the appropriate energy to effectively address the challenges that we have before us.
And I think it's absolutely true that you can love your country and do all the things you just got done saying, and at the same time not be a fan of President Donald Trump. And I think the problem that some people just frankly can't get past is that because at this moment in time, we have a president who's, if you believe every poll that's out there, is extremely unpopular, and that you saying all these positive things about your country or celebrating this 250th anniversary is somehow like saying that you agree with the course of this current administration. And my response to that would be that if you think for that the president is guilty of making this celebration all about himself, well, you can celebrate and not make it about him at all. And that you can do all these things and put up a flag and talk about what a great country we live in. And this country is going to outlive me, you, and most every leader we have on the political stage right now. And that's a good thing. And I think that people get too tangled up thinking about where we're at in this moment and not taking the broader view of saying, yeah, we have challenges. We have challenges today. We've had challenges 50 years ago, and we had challenges 200 years ago. But we do still, there's something about being an American, and there's something about that brings us all together. And again, I'm sure if you're an Italian, you feel strongly about Italy, and that's also great. And there's nothing wrong with any of those things. But I think we just to try to remove the present day politics from as much of this as you can is probably going to be helpful.
And I think focusing on the local is really important. That has always been such a huge part of American identity, is a real connection with the local and in many respects with the land, the land around where you are and taking care of the place where you are. and then expanding that outwards. In the same way, we care for our families, and then because we care for our families, we care for the town, the community in which we raise our families, and then we care for the broader setting in which that community exists. This is all continuous. I think another thing that we do besides expressing gratitude for our country at this time of celebration in the life of our country, I think we can tell the stories of our families, especially if we have children. What we know is that children who grow up knowing something about their family history end up doing much better than children who don't. They have much, much higher levels of self-confidence. They have an expanded and deeper social identity because they know something about where they came from, which gives them more confidence about where they're going. I think this is true of family history. I think it's true of national history as well. We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. So what is your question for me?
There is a popular dog park in Minneapolis that has served local residents for decades and has become an important gathering place for both dogs and their owners. Recently, however, evidence has emerged that the land may contain Native American burial mounds dating back hundreds of years. Indigenous groups are asking that the site be protected and restored out of respect for those who are buried there. Closing the park would preserve a piece of history and, I suppose, honor a cultural tradition, but it would also eliminate a heavily used public space that benefits people living today. So I guess maybe the question for you, Rick, is when the interests of the living conflict with honoring the dead, how should society decide what matters most?
This is something that we always negotiate. This is not, can't be, there's no direct answer to the broad question of how do we decide what matters most. It's something that we negotiate. We negotiate these sorts of things all the time where there's competing values, competing things of great importance where we're trying to feel like, okay, we can't have them both. What do we do here? We sometimes move cemeteries. Right. When we'll say, OK, but we're not just going to build a factory on top of the cemetery. We're going to hold a ceremony and remove, the people to another place and rebury them. We might do that. I think that would be a possibility. And in the same way that we would do it respectfully and reverently, like we do with a more recent cemetery. But I don't know that. That's something that, whenever that is done, that has to be negotiated within the community, among the people who are there and who care about that place. And so as an outsider, I can't really comment and give an answer to how this should be done. But I say that, there has to be a good faith negotiation about what takes precedent here.
And again, I think it's important that to realize that this is being used as recreational space, not, they're opening up a tire factory. And one thing, and I sent this to you in advance of today's show, but there was a columnist for the St. Paul Pioneer Press. His name's Joe I knew I'd have a problem with that name. Joe Suchere, I think is how you say his name. And he wrote about this issue. And according to him and according to his reporting, that one of the organizers that thinks that the city should decommission this dog park says that dogs are spiritual beings and can absorb prayers intended for a native soul who has left this mortal coil. I don't know. I mean, I think most people would hear about dogs stealing prayers as a little bit of a step too far. And according to everything I've read on this, that because of its location, and I don't know exactly where it is in Minneapolis, but it's just very popular. There are, and nobody's going out tearing down these mounds. I mean, it's they've coexisted for a long time. And not surprisingly, people in the broader community were like, hey, this is a really valuable space. We probably talked about this on the show before, but when it comes to these decisions, to me, I think in almost every case, we should prioritize the benefits of the people who are alive versus the people who are dead. And I just don't see this being any different than that. So to me, this is not as difficult of a situation. I mean, yeah, get the community involved, but it sounds like from everything I've read, and we'll link to one of these stories, is that the community of the people who use this park think it's fantastic and want to keep using this as a park, as a dog park.
Some of the people, but obviously some people are objecting to that use.
Well, yeah, obviously, right? We wouldn't have this discussion if there wasn't an objection. But I mean, do you think the dog stealing prayers argument is like a valid argument?
I don't like to outright dismiss something because I haven't heard it or don't understand it. And I don't understand it. I would even be surprised, I think, to find that it was a widespread cultural belief
in that
native community. Mm-hmm. I would guess that it's probably something that has been used to voice an objection by one or two people, and that other people have assented to it without maybe understanding it. But I don't know that. I mean, this is why I say it's a matter of negotiation. I'd want to talk to a lot more people. I'd also want to talk to some elders in that community and see what they say about it.
So you think I'm oversimplifying it by saying the needs of the living are more important than the needs of the dead?
Yeah, I don't think it's a simple consequentialist calculation like that. Because if you were to apply that kind of reasoning, we would never have, we would never feel bound to honor our word to those who have passed, because nothing's of any use to them anymore once they're passed. The what's of use to those living always outweighs those who have died.
So I'll just make up a situation here, but let's say you're 15 years old and your grandmother's dying and you're very close to her. And you tell your grandmother, and her name will just, I don't know your grandmother's name, but we'll say her, for this discussion, her name's Bertha. And you tell Bertha that you love her very much, and if one day you are lucky enough to have a daughter, you will name her Bertha. And that's what you say as a 15-year-old sincere pledge to your dying grandmother. Mm-hmm. 10 years later, you get married to somebody, and this comes up in a discussion about, she's like, as you talk about your family, you're like, oh, I had maybe the best grandmother ever. I was lucky to have her for 15 years, but she's still died too young. And you tell her about this pledge you made that you would name your firstborn daughter Bertha. And your wife's reaction is, that is about, again, sorry to any Berthas out there, but that is like not a name I want to have my child on. But that's like making a promise to someone who's dead. How much do you fight for that? It's hard to know if at 15 you would make that promise, but let's say you did.
I really wanted to name one of our sons after my grandfather, whose name was Emmett.
Okay, that's like not a bad name.
Yeah, my wife thought, we can't name our child Emmett. She was just opposed to that.
And better than Bertha.
And this was like almost 30 years ago. So yeah. It was at that time, now odd names are a lot more cool than they were at the time. But I mentioned that to our son when he was like 15 years old. He says, oh, I wish you'd name me Emmett. Anyway, so Bertha might not be that bad of name in another 15 years. I think that's missing the point.
Okay.
You can say something at a moment like that, and it's not really what you meant. But that's not really dishonoring your grandmother's wishes, because you don't even know if she like she's dying at the time.
She may have been out of consciousness.
Who knows? You say that. But if there's like if there's something really important to her that she asks you to do and you say yes, I will do it, I think you should do it. And even if it becomes really inconvenient to you later. And if you don't think you can, you shouldn't agree to it. So I think we should keep our word. And we right now here we are in La Crosse and we're kind of locked in by geographical features. We have bluffs on one side and the river on the other.
We're a long and skinny city.
Yes. And we really need more room for housing.
Yes.
We've got two very large cemeteries in the city that are in prime real estate spots.
Everything you said is true.
And you would say, yeah, there's no problem. Just build right over them, right?
I know there would be a huge problem if, like, some developer said, you know.
But according to you, there's no ethical problem. I would just build right on top of them.
I may have said this before. I think the reason, and I've never studied this, but I'm like almost sure it's true, and sorry to be insensitive here, so bear with me. But like the reason we bury dead bodies is for the vast long swath of our history, we knew that they could cause disease and it gets like gross. So you have to put them somewhere, and putting them 6 feet into the ground keeps them from not, you know, getting your people, you know, I don't need to explain why, right? I mean, obviously that's what we did. And we obviously, if you're going to bury someone somewhere, you're probably going to put a little sign above it that said, here lies, you know, Grandma Bertha. And like, that's all fine. But I think in today's world where we have more choices, it just almost to me seems, and this is where I'll get in trouble, like unethical, especially in certain parts of our world where we are densely populated, to continue to take up land for this when we have so many other choices. It just, that just seems like bad.
So this has to be something we talk about on a future episode is what do we want done with our bodies when we die?
I think
that is a big ethical choice.
Well, I can give you my whole answer to that very quickly. And it's about what we want to do with the body, how you want to be, do you want to service, all that stuff. And my whole belief is that all of that is done for the people who survive you. So to me, it's like, whatever they want's fine. Because like I'm not around, and if they think that they want some big service and these songs picked because that reminds them of me, great, do that. And if they just want to forget about me as quickly as possible, which I mean, fine, I guess, you know, do that too, then that's what you want to do. So I think it really is up to the people who are living to make those choices, because that's why you don't have funerals for people who are dead. You have funerals for people who are alive.
This brings us back to the burial mounds in the dog park.
Okay.
This is a dispute about people who are alive right now. And it's there's two different groups. There's the dog owners who use the park. There's the native members who identify as those who are buried there were their ancestors.
And the dogs
and they
that
have
are
different
their prayers.
Or whatever, if that's the main reason or not, it's whatever. It's like, I think it signals to them some kind of disrespect, saying this is just land that we're just using for a dog park, and
it clearly must do.
So this is why it's a negotiation among people who are living right now. It's not really about honoring it's not honoring the wishes of those who are dead. It is a negotiation between two people who have different ideas in mind about the use of this land. And we negotiate that stuff all the time. That's what this is.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and that will touch on many of the topics we spoke about today, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Please have a wonderful Oh, here we go again.
It
is a semi-quincentennial, and thank you for listening.